It was about the first grade when I started getting into trouble at school, and I was a wiggly little boy, and I couldn't sit still. I couldn't keep quiet. I wanted to dance all the time. I was flirting with all the girls and everything. And of course, this was like 1981, 1982, and there wasn't really a particular infrastructure for being able to handle a wild boy other than discipline. And so instead of being able to go out and get the wiggles out in recess, I would have to sit inside, which was just like I was like a little caged tiger. And this just kept going on through my schooling. And in the early days, like 1980s, they would give little boys Ritalin, and they would give little boys like Dexedrine and Nortrimin and these different medications to try to deal with why the boy had the wiggles. And you still had to sit still and raise your hand and be in this very industrialized kind of model for what education was. And so the effect that it has on little boys and little girls is that they tend to feel like there's something deeply wrong with them, that they are bad, that they are stupid. And that's really a lot of how I grew up, is that I wasn't going to be able to accomplish the things that a lot of the other little boys were going to be able to accomplish around me. And so as I got into adulthood and I started accomplishing a few things, I thought, well, maybe I am a little bit bright. And I went to school to be a marriage and family therapist. And I started for my first 10 years of doing that, specializing in working with young people in the community, kids that are having a lot of trouble in school, foster youth, adopted youth, kids that are getting in trouble in school, kids that are in these specialized schools, because I identified with them. I remember always having to be on timeout and always just having this kind of message to myself that I wasn't ever going to quite be good enough. And so I worked with these kids that were having trouble in school for a really long period of time before I ended up kind of working more with adults and doing more of the kind of human potential work that I'm doing now with my coaching.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jesse LeBeau.
We're here with the amazing Jeremy Van Wert. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fabulous. I'm so happy to talk to you. I love just the whole positivity vibe. It's so encouraging.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, speaking of, you know, positivity, but also well-dressed, what is your, do you have a tailor? You have a stylist? What's going on here? Where are we getting these good outfits?
You know, so here's the strange thing about this whole thing. So I really got into fashion and style about 5 or 7 years ago, and it's just people treat you different when you go around dressed well. It makes you feel better, and it's just such a great way to stand apart. And so I just love the whole kind of dapper look and everything like that. You just put a little bit of effort into matching the right patterns and into wearing more brilliant colors and stuff like that. It makes a huge difference.
Well, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Change your life, change your outfit, match the colors, and really, it is just a little bit effort that can make a big difference and set you apart.
It's absolutely right. It makes you feel like $1 million.
I love it. So where are you based out of for people who are wondering?
Yeah, I'm in California. I'm really close to where Tahoe is. And so I'm looking out the window at a beautiful forest, and it's nice to be able to walk outside and the birds are chirping and the ravens are flying around, and it's a beautiful place to be.
Something about nature and in a good body of water. I like to be near water, which I'm not right now. And I'm like, oh man, I'm going stir crazy, but I'm so glad that we were able to connect. Now you're doing great work, you know, coach, therapist, CEO, but how did you get to be doing what you're doing today? What's kind of the backstory for you?
So it was about the first grade when I started getting into trouble at school, and I was a wiggly little boy, and I couldn't sit still. I couldn't keep quiet. I wanted to dance all the time. I was flirting with all the girls and everything. And of course, this was like 1981, 1982, and there wasn't really a particular infrastructure for being able to handle a wild boy other than discipline. And so instead of being able to go out and get the wiggles out in recess, I would have to sit inside, which was just like I was like like a little caged tiger. And this just kept going on through my schooling. And in the early days, like 1980s, they would give little boys Ritalin. And they would give little boys like Dexedrine and Nortrimin and these different medications to try to deal with why the boy had the wiggles. And you still had to sit still and raise your hand and be in this very industrialized kind of model for what education was. And so the effect that it has on little boys and little girls is that they tend to feel like there's something deeply wrong with them, that they are bad, that they are stupid. And that's really a lot of how I grew up, is that I wasn't going to be able to accomplish the things that a lot of the other little boys were going to be able to accomplish around me. And so as I got into adulthood and I started accomplishing a few things, I thought, well, maybe I am a little bit bright. And I went to school to be a marriage and family therapist. And I started for my first 10 years of doing that, specializing in working with young people in the community, kids that are having a lot of trouble in school, foster youth, adopted youth, kids that are getting in trouble in school, kids that are in these specialized schools, because I identified with them. I remember always having to be on timeout and always just having this kind of message to myself that I wasn't ever going to quite be good enough. And so I worked with these kids that were having trouble in school for a really long period of time before I ended up kind of working more with adults and doing more of the kind of human potential work that I'm doing now with my coaching. But it really was this mission of love and compassion that I was on, because I just remember feeling so tremendously alone. And now that there's, you know, more research, more understanding of how these kiddos work, it is nice to be able to be one of the people that comes in and provides the kind of empathic understanding, not just to the kids, but also to the parents who are struggling.
Yeah, it takes a village, doesn't it?
Oh my gosh, it does. It takes a full approach. It takes the teachers, it takes the coaches, the basketball coaches, the football coaches, the marching band coaches. It takes all of these people. It takes the parents, it takes the special teachers that do the smaller classes. It takes peers, it takes everyone.
Yeah. For you, in your journey, when you were acting up and getting in trouble and basically, it sounds like being a normal kid, what do you feel like turned it around for you? Was it a specific thing? Was it this community like you're talking about, where having multiple influences? Is there anything that stands out in your mind that helped you kind of turn a corner?
Yeah, for me, it was music. And I realized that I was really enthusiastic about banging on a drum. And so I started playing drums in late grammar school and into junior high, and set a number of goals for myself and really focused on that. And through that was really able to prove to myself that I could be good at something. And so in being able to get into like competitive drumming, the kind of drumming that I was into, it was something that started building my confidence in something. And so, you know, unfortunately, I had written off myself academically, and so I was still class clowning, but I was a really good drummer, and I could drum fast, and I could drum well. And so for me, that was my first real testing ground of going, there's something more to me than just really being a troublemaker. And it wasn't until I got into, you know, college and started really exploring myself and my capacity for thinking that I thought, well, maybe this level of focus, this level of diligence and dedication is something that I can devote to something that's heady, that's academic, that's philosophical, that can really actually benefit other people. And so I went from drumming really into doing work with people and young people and everything like that. I still drum here and there, but it was really music that helped me find my me.
I love it. I love it. And I'm asking for selfish reasons on this. Well, two things. How old were you when you found the drum and that started to unfold in your life?
I was about 12 years old when I started really getting into it. And I played the rock and roll drum set, and I got into this whole marching band thing, which is this big kind of world that's really exploded over the last 25 years.
Yeah, yeah. Did you guys have to wear special shoes in the marching band? In my marching band, there was special shoes.
When you're performing, you do have to wear the Bucks or the Hush Puppies, the marching band shoe. And okay. So you do the training in these wonderful cross trainers, and you wear these terrible shoes for the actual performances.
Yeah, they look good, but they hurt your feet.
Right.
Got it. So you got to be a part of the band, and that provided you also, in addition to something that you started to see improvements in confidence, also a group of your peers that had a similar passion, and you guys were able to come together. Because I was thinking, oh, drumming could be kind of a solo thing, which of course, like for practicing, I guess kind of anything can be. But then you also had that community that you were spending time with each week, or probably each day for that period of the day. Do I have that right?
No, you're absolutely right about that, because and this goes into what any human being needs, which is a community surrounding them. And so the marching band drumming is communal. It is everybody having to be very much in sync. And so you end up making really close friends with the people that are around you, lifelong friends. And so for me to be able to actually have a community of other kind of bando misfits that I was able to surround myself with and listen to super nerdy music with and get really into that sort of thing. It was comforting. I had a community around me where I felt like I belonged, which is really, really super important for a young person. And, you know, one of the reasons that we're seeing this heightened amount of anxiety and depression in young people is that their communities are more removed than they have been in the past. Just yesterday, my grandfather has a classic car that is displayed at the California Automobile Museum. And I went there yesterday with my grandfather had a 1940 Lincoln Zephyr, just a beautiful car. And all of the people there were octogenarians. They were in their 70s and their 80s. And I was actually struck as a man in my 40s at how hypersocial this generation is, because I'm used to having lulls in a conversation in a room with other people where I pick up my phone and I look at it. I did not have a single second to do that, because this generation, they were raised on you talk, you shake hands, you look at people, you hang out with people, you introduce people. And with the younger generations, it's more of a removed community where their community is more online. Their community is a bit more removed from where they're at. Maybe it's a gaming community. Maybe it is a Discord server or something like that. They're doing less of that very face-to-face social thing. I just thought it was I was struck by it yesterday, just being a Gen Xer in a room full of boomers, that they're very, very socially I wanted to use the word demanding, but that's the way that humans are supposed to be, is that you relate to each other very face-to-face, a lot of conversation. And so I got that sort of thing out of being a drummer and fitting into a community face-to-face, because it was very hands-on.
I love that so much. And I think it's something that we're really yelling from the mountaintops as well, of, hey, get off the phones, get off the tablets, get off the video games, and find your tribe and connect in person. Go, and as we say, team up, find your people. And so when I hear stories, I'm like, oh, this is such a perfect example of you're going through it. Maybe things aren't like unbearable, but they are having some struggles. And you find a thing, you find a passion, because so many people are going and they don't have anything they're excited about. It's so, when you're not excited about anything, it's easy to get, you know, anxious. It's easy to get depressed. It's easy to fall into these gaps. So when I hear these stories, it's like, oh yes, man, I love it. And that's, if you're a kid, if you're listening to this and your kid is one of those people that is struggling with one of these mental health ailments that is just plaguing us today, or they're just lonely, then let's help them get out there and find their drum, find their marching band, find their good, comfortable, hopefully the shoes are better by now, you know, they've improved it. It's probably Crocs, I'm guessing. It's probably some type of, you know, ugly, just casual wear. So yeah, no, I appreciate you. I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think that is so relatable. And it's like, it's not just a new thing. This is something that people have been looking forever. And I love that you're like, once I started to have some success, it gave me more confidence. And we talk about all the time how you can't give your kid confidence. They have to earn it by making the marching band and earning a solo and doing really good at the game and the performance and all those things. That's something that, you know, your parents can't praise you. They can't pay for it. You have to actually achieve it on your own, and you build up that stack. So I'm curious, Jeremy, from once you're into college and now all of a sudden you're seeing like, hey, I'm actually kind of smart. I think I could, do some things with my life. How did you get excited and how did you get steered into the direction of what you're doing right now? Or did you go and do something else and then found your way back to this? I guess I was making an assumption there.
Yeah, I got a very good, safe job with the Social Security Administration, and it was just absolutely dreadful. And so what I did part a couple of years into that was I need a path out of this sort of thing. And I got myself into a master's program to do the marriage and family therapy and really found myself drawn towards youth. And when I got out of school and I got a job with a local social services agency, that is 100% what we did, is we served the local youth and parents. And it was really, really striking to me when I got out there and really started doing the work. Working with the kids is something that I was very well trained to do. I understood behavior modification. I understood trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy for a child that has undergone a trauma. And there's this obvious and very important focus on the wellness of the child. But what I often saw were parents being left behind, because all of the meetings were about how can we help modify things for the child. And often these things, it demanded more of the parents and more of the teachers to be able to do this behavior modification or reward system or something like that. And these parents, I was finding that they were just, in many, many cases, really fabulous people that were very dedicated, and they were absolutely exhausted. And maybe they were people who had opened their homes to an adopted child. And maybe they were people who had taken foster children. Maybe they have their own child that has some sort of neurodivergence like autism or ADHD or something like that. And the real issue that these parents were consistently dealing with was just feelings of inadequacy, feeling like they were never enough, feeling like the work that they were doing was just something that was not sufficient for the wellness that they wanted to provide their children. Because you as a parent, you want to love your child into success, whether this is your biological child or your adopted child or foster child or grandchild. You want that child to be successful. And there's this just natural tendency within you to feel like my love should be enough. And when your love isn't quite enough, there really is a sense of inadequacy. And so what I would often work with parents on, I would do the work with the child, and I would also check in strongly with parents on how is the load for you? How are you coping? And oftentimes these parents, they didn't have their own therapist. They didn't have their own coach. They weren't seeking their own help other than maybe taking some Xanax every once in a while or taking an antidepressant to just numb themselves out, which, I mean, it's one way to deal with it, but it's also something that covers up just the profound difficulty that there can be in parenting a challenging child. And, you know, children in foster care are twice as likely to suffer with depression and about five times more likely to have anxiety than children that are not in the foster care system. And the AMA notes that 80% of children in foster care have significant mental health issues, compared to about 18 to 22% of children that are not in the foster care system. And so these kids that are special needs, these kids that are fostered, these kids that are adopted, they are a special load sometimes to parent. And parents can often feel like they're tremendously overtaxed. And it, you know, it does a lot to their own self-esteem when they're constantly putting the child first and avoiding the self-care for themselves.
Excuse me. Yeah, I see that a lot as well, where the parents feel like it's their burden and they have this heavy weight on their shoulders. And anything that is going wrong with their child, they're like, oh, it's my fault, especially with moms. And that's so devastating. So if you are a parent listening to this, just know you aren't alone. Being a parent is a very difficult job. It seems like it's getting harder and harder every day with technology changing and new apps. And the more we know, the more I'm like, we realize we don't know. And so it is a challenging, difficult time, but no, there is hope and you aren't alone. And, you know, we laugh all the time because we feel like, how is there not like a guidebook or, you know, a test that you have to take to become a parent to make sure you're qualified? Because I'm pretty sure almost no one would pass it. And, you know, even if you did pass it, you could do the perfect thing and a kid may go completely a different direction. Your second kid is a, you know, straight A, perfect. And a third one is another different direction. And you did the same thing with all three kids. There's so much variables in all of this. What are some of the biggest mistakes you see parents making outside of just taking it all on and being stressed and anxious themselves that they're not doing enough? What are some of the biggest pitfalls you see parents making?
Inconsistency. And this is really hard. This is a much easier said than done thing. And I would often see the parents become much more strict and diligent when they were being witnessed parenting by others than they were in the home. And the child picks up on that lack of continuity and they begin to lose trust in the consistency of what is being said to them. And so a parent that demonstrates maybe a heavy hand in the presence of others and then out of total exhaustion really isn't nearly as consistent with that sort of thing when it's just family home time. You just realize that family home time far exceeds what the exposure time is when you're in front of other people. And so it really is a lot about the consistency, following up a move of discipline with a move of love and compassion, that life isn't just simply about consequences. It is also about joining in and having fun with, planning fun times, and emphasizing the fun and the positive over the negative and the discipline problems. Because the child is learning how they are defining themselves. And when they are seem to be defined by the trouble that they're getting into, they begin to wear that as a part of their identity, if you will. The second thing is, and this is a very difficult thing, when a child is having some problems at school and you sit down with the school team to make a plan, there's something. It's in California, in a lot of places, it's called an IEP, an Individualized Education Plan. When you sit down with the school, you have to understand they have different goals than you have. Their goal is to locate the least expensive plan for helping your child get through the next grade at school. And your goal is to try to find the most effective educational environment for your child. So if your child is one that may need to be moved from a regular schoolroom into a special school, this can be a really dangerous thing to do because the schools that they are often moving a child into, if you spent 3 hours in one, you would feel crazy. Because the environment around these kids is really, really emotionally charged. there's kids, other kids that are having problems and temper tantrums and slamming doors and everything like that. Imagine trying to learn or retain any information when somebody is always screaming. And so what happens is children are sometimes put into these environments, and it really is detrimental to who they become, because these environments, while it saves the school a bundle of money to put them in these environments, you have to be sure that you understand what this environment actually is that your child is going into. And so I wouldn't necessarily buy what is said to me from school officials at face value. I'd want to know more. What is this educational environment? Can I talk to any of the other parents before my child is there? Would my child be better served in an environment where they can learn at their own pace? Would they be better off in a Waldorf school? Would they be better off in some other kind of alternative education, like a charter school or something like that, that is more for maybe your child is creative. Maybe your child has musical gifts. Maybe your child is just done with high school and needs to go to junior college a couple of years early. And that change of environment, that environment being so important, is something that parents really need to be aware of when they're considering the options for their child that might be a little different than other kids.
And I think so many parents aren't even aware that there are options, and you don't necessarily just have to take the thing that they're recommending.
Yes.
Have you found that as well?
Yeah, parents often sit down, and the schools are very, very good at providing a sales pitch. This school is so good. Your child's going to get 20, complete attention the whole time. Your child, if they have a hard day, they can go and sit on the bench outside. They can always go shoot hoops if they're not feeling good. And it all sounds really good. But when the child gets there, what's the environment actually like? Are people breaking the windows of the classroom because they're having a bad day? Are there kids having to be restrained several times a day by adults because they are becoming out of control? You can't learn in an environment like that, and you don't have to accept that. You can ask, what other environments are there that are on offer? And if you have to get yourself an educational advocacy group to work with you, it's absolutely worth it, because they often know what the law is and can help you understand as a parent what your rights are better than what some of these school districts are going to try to tell you your rights are and are not.
Man, that's so good. I feel like that applies to so many other areas of life, like whether it's just even your own health. You got to be the CEO of your own health. You go to one doctor, you get one answer, you go to someone else, you get a completely different answer. You're like, okay, what's their interest? And unfortunately, so many of these things come down to the bottom line. And so you have to look at it and be like, oh yeah, okay, well, this is actually what is going to be our best option. Or doing the research and finding those people that can advocate for you, which is so great. I love that one. I'm curious your perspective on this one. As someone who has done therapy for a long time and has transitioned into doing coaching, do you feel like therapy can be reinforcing a bad habit of focusing on your negative, your past, and things that you're unhappy with in your life all the time?
Thank you, thank you, thank you. So, therapy and coaching. Therapy can be a wonderful thing when you are dealing with a roadblock that you can't get past and you're trying to figure out where it came from. Are you traumatized? Are you dealing with major emotions and you don't know how to regulate them or where they came from, and you need the tricks and the tools to be able to do that? Therapy, this is very simplistic here, but therapy is kind of looking like today and backwards in your life to try to find out the insight and the way to cope with where you are. And the coaching, it generally is supposed to start today and go into the future. Where is it that you're going? Now, your question was about, is it super valuable to like dwell maybe on some old problems? And the answer is You got to do that work first. You really have to find out, why is it that I self-sabotage? Why am I drinking so much alcohol? Why do I have behaviors that are detrimental to my own physical and emotional health? That's therapy, okay? But the coaching model is the, okay, let's figure out where you're roadblocking yourself right now. Let's figure out your values. Let's figure out your goals. And let's build that sustainable plan to get you from here to there. You feel lost in life. You feel like there is more gas that you have in the tank, but you just need some accountability. You need somebody to stand there with you and go, yeah, you totally can do this. Because you can do this, you can do this, and you can do this. And so you can definitely do this. So the coaching model is what I would call more of a proactive model for your future, where you have somebody who is in consistent contact with you, that is checking in with you daily to make sure that, you know, whether it's the weight loss thing, whether it's the fitness thing, whether it is the mindset thing, so that you're really, you know, actually moving forward. And unfortunately, what does tend to happen, and this is because of the way that therapy is billed, therapists make their money through the hourly session cost. And I'm not necessarily saying that therapy stops being useful at a certain point, which, you know, for every single person that is different. But when somebody just simply stays in that processing stage for that prolonged period of time, there comes a point where it's like, okay, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with the stuff that you know? All right. And getting yourself right in your spirit, in where you are with your identity and where it is that you want to go, and then building an actual tangible plan that you can look at, and you know where you're going. You realize that you have the ability to heal, you have the ability to move forward, and sometimes all you need is somebody to just walk with you, keep you going in the right direction, and help you prove to you that you have what it takes. So yeah, there comes a point where, okay, you've processed it. You know what to do. And so let's get going. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, I'm all about the action taking. That's one of the big things. I saw Jack Canfield, the creator of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, do an event live, and he held up $100 and said, who wants it? It's available. And people are like, oh, I want it. Other people, oh, I'll take it. And he just stands there and holds it until someone actually comes and takes it out of his hand. And I was an adult when I saw that. I never forgot it. And I've done that at every talk that I've ever given since then, because all of this information, all of the motivation and inspiration, those are all great. But we all have access to all of those things every day on our smartphone. We have the history of everything in the palm of our hand. But some people are going and having incredible lives where they're successful, happy, good relationships, doing the things that they love. And other people are completely miserable and can't get it together. And the difference is they all have access to the information, but some people are actually doing something with that information. And so, yeah, that's something that I kind of see in that therapy model that's frustrating, because, oh, they just develop, oh, I just have this buddy that I go and I vent to, you know, every week. And it's like, well, if it helps you, okay, good. But I heard it explained this way one time. You know, you're a person and you went through some very traumatic experience that, you know, was just so unfair and a difficult thing. And at 19, we look at that person and you feel bad about it and you're still affected by it, and we have empathy for you. At 49 years old, we probably are like, like maybe at some point you need to move on and not make your whole identity around this one thing that happened to you for your own sake, right? But where is the medium ground? You know, and the answer is somewhere. And I would argue, the sooner that you can get to it, the better, right? For your own good, and not letting someone else have power over you. And Dr. Phil always says, you know, what's worse than being hurt for 3 years? Well, being hurt for 3 years in a day. And so if you can figure that out and take that action. So I appreciate you breaking down that coaching model of like, let's actually do something, you know, yes, you know, we have these tools, you know, with the CBT and these different things that you have training in and are experienced in, and those are great. And we can draw on those as needed, but let's focus on what you found out when you were a kid. Hey, I found this thing called music and I really like this and it makes me feel great and I'm connecting with other people. How can we get you to that thing sooner? Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You got me kind of bursting at the sides here because I work with a lot of people who are in their midlife and they oftentimes have become perfunctory in the way that they perform life. They get up, they have breakfast, they have their coffee on the way to work, they do their work, they get off of work, and the rest of the day is scrolling and some TV watching, maybe some talking with the spouse, buying something, and then going to bed. And this continues. And so their year after year after year becomes a lack of real important interests. What am I doing with my life? What am I about? What are my interests? And these interests, these things that are wonderful to do, they really do make life meaningful. And so when I'm doing work with people, I'm often going, what do you like to do? And they don't know how to answer that question. Well, when I was younger, I was really into punk rock and I really liked that whole thing. I played a guitar. When's the last time you picked it up? Oh man, it's been 20 years. Why? A guitar is an easy thing to pick up. I mean, I play a drum set. That's not an easy thing to pick up.
Yeah.
and the neighbors don't like it so much. But, you know, something like a guitar, something like a trumpet, something like a basketball, it's something that you can do even into your midlife. And so what is it that you're doing to work yourself towards a personal goal that is meaningful to you? When you're an entrepreneur, the meaning is really built into it because every single day you're on little milestones to get yourself to the thing. But, you know, I started at the Social Security Administration. I've never worked with a larger group of alcoholics than I did when I was working for the Social Security Administration because it was drab, it was boring, constantly having people upset coming in and yelling at you. And there was just a lack of personal ambition and meaning there. It just hung in the air like smoke. And when you're working in an environment where you're around, you know, they say you are the top five people that you hang out with, that really is it. Are you in a space where you're around other people that are encouraging you to do great things and to have high aspirations and to be performing great interests? I love working on classic cars. I love writing. I love podcasting. I love interviewing people. I do a lot of things around in the yard. I live rurally, and so I'm constantly doing this yard work, taking trees out and working with my neighbors on things and stuff. And so the busyness and the feeling that I'm giving of myself, not just to me, but also to others, is something that provides to me the sense that I have a space in this world. And so the need for the individual to really feel like they have their space. And I'm not saying that busyness is meaning because it's not, but when you feel that the things that you do are meaningful to you and that they're contributing to making the world a little bit of a better place, that is something. It fights anxiety, it fights depression, it fights alcoholism, it fights all of these things.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, man. Find your why. If you're listening or watching this right now, you know, this isn't just for your teen, but also for you. And that's the tricky thing. And that's why I like working with kids, is the whole gambit of life is just in front of them, right? The world's their oyster. They can choose to go any direction. it does get more complicated when you have a wife and a career and maybe some debt that you're working to pay off and have that on your back and you're doing these different things. But you got to find a way to incorporate it because life is so short and you don't want to miss out on these things. Like you said, whether it's yard work or music or connecting with people on podcasts, interviewing, like whatever those things are, it's not too late for you to pour into those and have some fulfillment. You know, you can have all this success, but if you don't have fulfillment, it's the ultimate failure. So you said one thing that is something that I am absolutely obsessed with right now, and I have been for a while, and it's scrolling on the phone. Yep. So in your practice, in your work with parents, with teens, with just anybody, what are you seeing the impact that the phone is having on how people are living their life?
So I'm not going to count myself as immune from this sitting atop a hill and looking down at the poor scrolling people, because I am one of those people. And it is something that it's so rewarding for your synapses, because it's just constant entertainment. You make a decision usually within the first second and a half of a video if it's something that you're interested in. And there's been studies on this that talk about the shortening of attention span and these sorts of things. Though also the wonderful thing about social media and everything is that there's more wonderful conversations that are going on, more long form podcasting, more books on recording and everything like that, that you can listen to that actually help you become more knowledgeable and your attention span stay high. What I would definitely recommend is that there has to be some limit with the scrolling, because not only is a lot of the scrolling, if you're doing it on, you know, specific platforms that focus on current events and so forth, it can be really depressing. You're watching the fall of a civilization. You're watching the end of so many things. It is disturbing at times to see what's happening everywhere around the world all at once. It's disturbing to your inner peace and what you view the world to be, and you're part of that world. So limiting or eliminating, but I'm trying to be realistic here, limiting the number of minutes a day that you do this. There's an app called Opal that you can download that will, after a certain period of time, shut down your phone usage. And so that you can get phone calls and text messages from people, but your scrolling is done for the day. And oftentimes people lose track of time when they're doing that because it's so mesmerizing. And so if you're somebody who's doing 45 minutes, 2 hours, 3 hours a day, it's having an effect on your mood. It's having an effect on your sleep and a detrimental one.
It's so crazy because I think at this point, everyone knows this. And if they don't know it by now, it's shocking, really. But no one, for the most part, is doing anything to change it. Of course, there are people that have, that are working on that. But the vast majority is just like everyone's turning into a zombie. And we talk about it with parents all the time of, hey, you don't want your kids to be like this. But then they're watching you be on the phone. And the part that's the most frustrating is the same thing that frustrates me in speaking. When I go to a school and kids come up afterwards, after I talk, and they're all excited and want to share with me something that's going on in their life or a big dream or a goal they have, it's awesome. But I almost half the time after doing it for many years. After doing it for so many years, you start to see like, okay, cool. I'm glad that you're sharing this with me and telling me this, but are you going to actually follow through and do it? Because most of the time, it's like going to church, you get excited, the music's in the air, the Holy Spirit's flowing, you get out of there, you're going to go be a great person. And then by noon, you're yelling at the waitress at your Sunday meal afterwards, you know? So it's an interesting thing, so much so that we put together our program to help kids and work with them one-on-one to actually do these things, because it's hard to follow through. And that's what's frustrating me with me at the phone, is I feel like so many people could be like, oh yeah, I want to do this and I want to be better and I want to improve my life. And we'll go, okay, well, it's going to help anxiety, depression, self-harm, stress, all these areas that they're struggling in, sleep, which you mentioned, which is so important. But knowing all of that, I don't know if any human has the self-control and discipline to stop it unless they use different apps like Opal and the ones you just mentioned.
You know, it's made honestly for a less fun world. And I've always been a huge fan of heavy metal. And remember when I was younger, I would go to some of these concerts and I would feel lucky to be alive afterwards. It was so much body movement, and I'd be up towards the front and I'd look behind me and there'd be this huge like cavalcade of bodies flying and everything. And it was an athletic event to attend one of these concerts. It was really, really crazy to be at a Korn concert, to be at a Megadeth concert or something like that. And I more recently have gone to concerts like this, and I just see everybody standing there like this, videotaping what's going on the stage. And it's just so isolating. It's just, you have 1,000 videos of the exact same performance in the same room, and everybody's posting it on their social media and stuff like that. And the lack of the actual audience participation part, and this is just one thing out of so many things, the conversation with the person behind you in line at the grocery store, it's not happening because everybody's looking at their phones. Your contact with the person that is sharing life for just a moment in proximity to you, it's really gone away. And that used to be an important part of just being a human, was the random contact and communication with other people. And imagine it's affecting that person too. We talk about this epidemic of loneliness when so many fewer people are talking to other people. It used to be that there was a nod of the head when you pass somebody when you're walking down the street, and it's just different now. And so you're right. There is a lack of personal discipline going on. It's where something like Opal might be able to help, or certainly just recognizing that scrolling is the same as any other addiction. It's hitting the same receptors in your brain that an addiction is hitting. To an addiction to pain pills, an addiction to alcohol. Whereas alcohol numbs you out and takes you out of the present moment, the scrolling does the same thing. It's just that you can drive afterwards.
Yeah. It's so sad to see. I was talking to someone the other day and they were like, yeah, it used to be in school. The buzzer would go off. Sound more like a sports reference. The bell would go off and you'd go into the hallway and it was just mayhem. That's how kids are yelling at each other. Hey, what's going on? Haven't seen you in a while. And now they go into the hallway and they're all on AirPods and their phones and it's silent.
Yeah.
And it's silent and they're all zombies and everyone's in their own little world. I agree with you, you know, during COVID with the masks, it affected my mood in such a major way, just not even being able to walk by someone and smile at them and say hello. That made a huge, huge impact.
It's the youth culture right now is quite different. And it's not that they don't have a sense of humor. They do. I toured during the summertime when I was young with a drumming group. And we used to drive all over the United States and play. And, you know, at the time, we were all a bunch of 18 through 22-year-old boys and girls. And the humor culture and the practical joking culture was something where at least twice a day, we would end up laughing so hard that we couldn't stand up because somebody would play a joke on somebody or somebody would say something sarcastic that was just really well-timed or something like that. And I just remember that that laughing a couple times a day to the point where I couldn't breathe. And it was just, it was such a joyful time. I became the CEO of that group in the last 5 years. And so I went on tour with them and I was so surprised to see these young people, they didn't laugh. They would stand in line together and there would be hushed tones in talking because all of them would be scrolling on their phones instead of laughing, joking, feeling community with, and being in humor and in sociality with one another. It was really striking to me, having been one of them 25 years ago and remembering the strong levels of joy that I felt, and then just seeing that joy just kind of gone and it being so serious.
Yeah. Yeah, get them off the phone. Get off the phone yourself. It's a happier life, 100%. I want to ask you, if you were going to go back in time, actually, you know what? I'm going to redo that. If you, I take that back. If you were going to give one piece of advice for people watching this right now, it could be parenting advice, it could be teen advice, it could just be life advice in general, what would be your best piece of wisdom that you would share?
Going back in time to where everybody's kind of like starting their life journey. Always invest in yourself. You're never going to go wrong choosing things to do that invest in you, your talents, and your greatness. Whether it is an educational program, whether it is some sort of evening yoga course or something like that, always stay learning. You're never going to go wrong with your ability to invest in yourself, to develop new skills and new things that you did not know were there. And the other thing is the importance of spirituality. And I'm going to be really, really clear about this. I'm not talking about some form of religiosity. I'm talking about not ignoring the spirit that lives within you. That spirit needs to feel joy. That spirit needs to feel connection to the self and connection to the people around you. That spirit needs to feel happy. That spirit needs to be nourished, whether it is through prayer, whether it is through meditation or chakra work or communal worship, whatever it is that brings that spirit of love and peace to you. I always kind of feel like, well, spirituality is this religiosity thing that hurts people. Not exactly. It's a piece of the human spirit that has been a part of us since the dawn of mankind, a very important part of us. And so invest in your spirit. Don't ignore that. And invest in your personal development, whether you are 15 years old or 55. Learn new things and show yourself how incredible you actually are.
Love it. Jeremy, this was so great. Where can people find out more about you? Where's the best place for people to go check out?
Come to jeremyvanwoert.com. That's going to be in the description of this podcast. And that's a good place to kind of go to see what my philosophies are and everything like that. I also am the host of the Mindful Mutiny podcast that you can listen to on YouTube or Apple or Spotify. And I interview people who are living the highest version of themselves.